Welcome to Built to Go, a van life podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Wagg, coming to you from the College of Curiosity. This time it's episode 208, and we're going to discuss the possibility as to whether we need a van life code of ethics. Do these already exist? Should they exist? And should we be following one? We're also going to talk about Romex, that wonder wire that is in every home in America except shouldn't be in your van, a product review of an incredibly inexpensive solar controller, and a place to visit that's all around you. Of course, I shall explain. Thank you very much for joining me once again for episode 207. A number insofar as I know that has no significance, and I can't opine on that anymore. So I shall just jump right in. In the closet of my 1973 Winnebago Indian D22, there is tacked up on the wall a Winnebago camper's code of conduct. This is the original code of conduct from when the thing was built in 1972 or 1973. I'm not sure exactly when. And back then, there was this idea that if you were camping out in the wilderness, you should be following some sort of conduct. You should be behaving in a certain way. 50 years later, YouTube has decided that it is popular to produce videos about van life codes of conduct. Cheap RV Living just had a big rant about it, and I saw a couple of others, and basically they're complaining that van life people are so rude and messy that they're being forced out of places. Used to be able to camp at every Walmart in America, and now you can't because the van life people came in and left trash everywhere and dumped liquids all over the ground, were loud and obnoxious, and so on and so on. And so I think these YouTube videos are coming about now because people are chasing the algorithm, and for some reason the algorithm is favoring videos on van life conduct. But it's not a new idea. Like I said, I had one in my Winnebago that's 50 years old, and a lot of the stuff on there is common sense. But I wonder if we don't need some sort of a crowd-sourced document that doesn't belong to anybody, belongs to the community of van lifers, and maybe this should be at Van Life Wiki or Wikipedia even, or something like that, where people can discuss what goes on this list, and then maybe we have a voting system or whatever. Because, folks, while I don't think van lifers or people who consider themselves to be doing van life are the major problem, it is a problem. And I do know of one specific area that van life people can improve on. So let's just have a discussion, a rather one-way discussion, although I think this would be a great talk to have around a campfire. I'm sorry, at a computer and not a campfire right now. What are your responsibilities if you're out there living van life? First, as I've said before, you are a guest. You're almost always a guest, especially if you're boondocking. You're not on your property. You're on someone else's property, whether it belonged to a campground or somebody like Cracker Barrel who said it's okay for you to stay there, or Walmart or whatever, or if you paid for a campsite. If you go check into a hotel, you are called a guest. That's what you are. The only time you're not a guest is if you are on your own property. So for all the full-time van lifers out there, they're almost always guests. And that requires a different code of behavior than if you're on your own property, because you're affecting other people. And so while it's easy to start with something like Leave No Trace, Leave No Trace is a set of principles that has been adopted by people who love the outdoors for years. You can actually just Google it. It's 7 principles, Leave No Trace, and I'll just go down them really quickly here. And this list is from REI. I'm pretty sure they're all the same, but basically it is 1, plan ahead and prepare. Okay. 2, travel and camp on durable surfaces. That's an interesting one. What's a durable surface? Basically, you don't want to be leaving tire tracks that are going to last forever. You don't want to damage what you're camping on. Dispose of waste properly. Note that it doesn't say take it with you. Sometimes there are ways to dispose of waste without taking it with you, but it's still proper. Leave what you find. Leave only footprints, take only pictures. You've heard that before. Well, that's what that is here. Don't be picking up all the seashells on the seashore and taking rocks and things like that. Minimize campfire impacts. be careful with fire. Yes, and in many parts of the U.S. right now, you can't have a campfire. I know that when I'm going out to Colorado in June, I won't be allowed to have a campfire because there's just too much risk. Number six is respect wildlife. And that goes both ways. You know, you have to prepare to deal with bears if they happen to come into your camp and want to go after your food. Or you know that if you build your campsite right next to a den of bunnies, maybe you don't want to be there. Maybe you want to leave those bunnies alone. You know, just you're in their home. And the last one, number seven, and this is the one that's going to ruffle the most feathers, I think, is be considerate of other visitors. So, you know, there's seven things right there that if we wanted a van life code of ethics, we could start with. But there's some others we could talk about. For example, and this is something I haven't seen anybody talk about, van life is not very carbon friendly simply because we are driving vehicles that burn fossil fuels. I know there are a few examples where we aren't, and you could argue that if you were in a schoolie and you only drove 100 miles and left it parked for 2 weeks and used solar power, that 100 miles of driving would be fairly low carbon, and I can see that. But for a lot of us, and I'm talking about me here, I just drove 1,100 miles twice to spend a few days with friends. And I did sleep in the van in between, but my carbon footprint was huge for that. Maybe not as high as if I had flown, but certainly higher than if I had taken the bus. So that's something to consider. So maybe there should be a code of ethics thing about trying to minimize carbon footprints. Again, this is up for discussion. I don't actually know the answer. I would like to see some data as to how much of an impact that is. Part of also carbon impact is campfires. Campfires put a lot of carbon in the air, and how you dispose of waste can also deal with carbon. Also, having a pet. We've talked a lot about how dogs are the best security. A lot of people have dogs as for friends, you know, it gives them company on the road. Well, dogs have a huge carbon footprint. So that's something to consider as well. And nothing has a larger carbon footprint than having a kid. So what does that mean? If we have this in the code of conduct for van life people, you shall not have a kid? No. It's just know what your impact is and then try to mitigate where you can. Another thing that I could see added to the list is drive cooperatively. That is, drive in such a way that you are driving to help all other drivers reach their destinations efficiently and safely. I would really like to see more people adopt this. And to be fair, I've seen a lot of van lifers really obey speed limits. It seems like they are much more comfortable driving at slower speeds than people in cars, and I think that is a good thing. And why do you want to do this? Well, if you drive slower, it's safer, and you actually add less carbon. And you'll also save money, too. What you won't save is time, which is kind of the problem with the driving slow thing. But that would be something I would definitely want to add to the code of ethics. And part of that, and this is actually the big thing we need to talk about, is respect for truckers. Now, I'm not talking about respecting them on the road because they're gigantic vehicles that can squash you like a bug. That should be pretty much automatic. I'm talking about competition for parking spaces. Now, this is more of an issue in the RV community because their rigs tend to be bigger, and I know there's overlap, but there's this thought that, hey, I'm driving an F-350, I'm towing a 35-foot fifth wheel, heck, I am a big truck, so I'm going to go park with the trucks at the rest area. I'm going to go park with the trucks at the truck stop, and why not? It's the only place I can fit. It makes sense. They built those spaces for rigs like mine. Well, no, they didn't, and the difference is more than the size of the vehicle. You see, regulations require truckers to rest. They just can't drive all day. There is a clock running the entire time they're driving, and at some point, they are required by law to pull over and rest. And I think it's 10 hours. And they don't have a choice. They have to do this, or they can lose their license and thus their job. And those truck spaces at rest areas, and especially at truck stops like Love, Travel America, Pilot, and Flying J, those spots were built by private companies to give truckers a place to rest. And if you take up one of those spots, you could be tipping it over so that there's no space for the truckers. Now, obviously, sometimes there's plenty of space and it's not that big of a deal. But you will find that at 9 o'clock at night in certain parts of the country, there's no place to park a big rig. And that's an annoyance for you and me, but it's a really big problem for a truck driver. We can go down the road a bit, or we can plan better. Truckers can't. They have to go to these truck stops, and if they're full, they're in trouble. And that's why you see trucks parked along the shoulders before and after rest areas. It's usually because the rest areas are full. And we, doing van life and RV life, should be aware that our leisure activities are actually affecting other people's jobs. Now you could argue, well, my taxpayer dollars are paying for those rest area spots. I get to use them just as much as the truckers do. And if there were some sort of a legal case, I don't know that you would lose. But as a matter of ethics, I don't think people should make other people's jobs more difficult just for their leisure activity. Now, for most of us in vans, the solution to this is easy. We just park with the cars. Vans will fit in most car parking spaces, and truck stops and rest areas tend to have larger spaces than you would find in, say, you know, a shopping area in a city. So that's what you do. It doesn't matter how big your van is. You should always go where the cars are. Now, I just drove from Florida to Chicago towing a 27-foot trailer with a fairly long pickup truck. So I didn't go with the cars. I followed the signs at the rest areas, and the sign said trucks and RVs. So the rest area was designed for me, but I was still very conscious. I didn't spend the night there. I would rest in the afternoon, and then I would only park at night in places where I wasn't competing with too many other trucks. In fact, one night, I actually did sleep on the shoulder just past the rest area so that I wouldn't take up a spot for a trucker. So it sounds like a silly thing, maybe. You might think that, well, you know, you're just as important as they are. But again, it's their jobs. They're forced to do this. You have many more options than they do. So I would definitely add something along those lines to the code of ethics. Something else I would consider is, just as with maritime law, maybe an obligation to help out a van lifer in need. This is a little tricky because it may not be safe to do so. I recently stopped for an accident on an interstate because I saw a car. It was a bad accident, like five cars in front of me, and I saw the cars fly off the road, and one of them instantly had smoke pouring out of it. So in my ambulance, which has very little useful stuff in this case, I do have a very large fire extinguisher, so I grabbed that and ran up there. Maybe that kind of behavior should be encouraged by such a code of ethics. So it's just an idea. I don't have any documents for you to sign. We're not going to form a contract. But I do wonder if we might want to work on a collaborative document about van life ethics and kind of make the world better for everybody. Thank you to Kent and those of you who have subscribed to buymeacoffee.com/builttogo. Buy Me a Coffee is a service where you can just give me $5 as a one-time gift to say thank you for producing the podcast. Or if you really like the podcast, you can sign up for a membership and that money will be taken out every month. Some people do one, some people do the other. It's completely up to you, but what you're doing is making it so I don't have to run ads on the podcast, and I really like that. So if you like the podcast and you'd like to support it, head on over to buymeacoffee.com/builttogo, and you can buy me a gallon of diesel, and thank you very much. Tech Talk. I am messing with power down in Tiki Bagelland. This is household power. And the wire I'm using is a fairly expensive wire. It's UV grade 10-3 Romex. None of that matters. The wording doesn't matter. And actually, I should be using 10-2. But it's a type of wire that's encased in vinyl. And it's very commonly used in houses. Not in Chicago. It's actually not legal in Chicago. But in most of the country. And the UV-grade stuff is meant to be used outdoors, and it can be buried. And I'm trying to get power to my rigs, and I'm messing with this stuff. Anyway, this isn't about me trying to get power to the rigs. This is about this stuff and why it is no good for your van. Now, you might think this stuff sounds great. 10-2 means it's 10 average wire gauge, which is pretty thick wire. And the 2 means it's 2 conductors plus a ground. So if you buy 10-2, you get 3 wires. I'm using 10-3, which means 4 wires. I don't really know why I'm doing that, but maybe someday I'll want that 4th wire. Anyway, it would make some sense to use 10-2 Romex in your rig because you would just be building your rig just like a house. Why you shouldn't do that is because it's not a house. It's a vehicle. It moves. And Romex is not meant to move. This stuff is very, very stiff. And even while I was working with it, putting plugs on it and stuff like that, I could tell I was weakening it just by bending it back and forth. So if you put this in your rig and it's in a place where it vibrates, it's solid copper. There's no strands in this stuff. And eventually that solid copper is going to get weak and break. And then you're going to have a circuit in your rig that doesn't work, and you're not going to know why. You're not going to have any way to troubleshoot it. You're going to just flip a switch and nothing happens, and you're going to have to basically remove the entire wire to fix it, which is no bueno. Also, it's expensive. Yes, it's waterproof, it's armored, it's pretty tough, but it's just not meant for this kind of thing. So make sure that when you're planning your wiring for your van, you use a braided wire, something with strands, because that kind of wire is meant to vibrate, and you really, really want that. And you will notice that all the wire in your vehicle, whatever kind of vehicle it is, if you cut into any of the wire that comes with the vehicle, even at the batteries where it's super thick, it's braided wire, and that's why. So, no Romex in there. It would be a bad thing. Product review. I bought a few of these $12 solar controllers from Amazon because I have some batteries I need to charge, and I happen to have a bunch of extra solar panels because they came with the Scamp. So I have 4 100 watt panels that are just laying around, and I thought, well, I might as well use them. So I have these little battery banks that we use when we're sitting out by the river, and I thought, well, instead of running a cord from the camper or whatever, what if I just kind of set up a little charging station outside? And that's what I did. But this is low level charging. I'm not trying to charge my whole 200 amp hour battery here, so I didn't want to get a big fancy controller. So I got these $12 controllers. I got 2 of them because, hey, I'm fancy. And well, folks, I have to tell you, for $12, they work. I mean, I wouldn't want to build out a van with these things as a permanent thing, but if you were doing a low build, I think I just made up a new thing, a low-cost build or a no build, yeah, these will charge your batteries. In fact, these are kind of what comes with a lot of the panels that have a built-in controller. It's basically these things. So let me tell you about them. Again, we're talking about $12 here. These are 30 amp solar charge controllers. That's a good amount. These are pulse. These are pulse width modulation units. So these are not MPPT. These you will have to use in parallel. Each panel will have to be wired in parallel to use this thing up to 30 amps. You're not going to be able to do any of the fancy converting voltage into amperage stuff that the MPPTs do. But it's $12, folks. It's 1/10 the cost of a good MPPT controller. It also has a load on-off switch, which, you know, is this controversial thing, but basically you can use the controller as a switch to turn a light on and off, which most people don't use. And it has 2 USB ports. And it knows lithium. You can set your battery type in there, so it'll give it the proper charge profile. I mean, for $12, these things are a bargain. Now, I've been using one now, well, I used it all last summer. And basically, the thing I used it for the most was charging a battery that is for the boat project I'm working on, which is a whole other story. But I just ran alligator clips out of this thing to the battery, and the solar charges the battery. It's dead simple. So why wouldn't you just do this? Why not just use this controller? Well, they're cheap. That's it. I mean, they're cheap. They're cheap, and you get what you pay for. I mean, that's really the reason. They're small. They're polite. They have a digital display, but they're not going to be robust. I have seen stories where they just suddenly stop working, and I've even seen one where it caught fire. I always think that's probably a wiring error rather than something else. But folks, if you have some extra solar panels lying around, or you just want a very simple solar charging setup, it's hard to go wrong with these. In fact, the blue one is $12. If you want the black one, well, that's only $10. It's the same thing, pretty much. I don't know. Check these out at the link, all right? I'm just presenting these to you as a possible option for a way to charge batteries. You would not put these in a professionally built rig. You would not put these into any kind of robust rig where you have a lot of batteries. But if you have a situation where you have a battery, say, for a winch or a boat or like a shed, like I'm thinking about building a solar outhouse, this would be what I would use. And heck, if you want to get fancy, I haven't tried this one, but for $20, they sell an MPPT version, which should mean that you can wire in series, although reading the specs here, it doesn't look like it allows that, so I don't know what the point is. Anyway, I will have a link in the show notes. Check it out. You can do solar for very, very cheap, and this is a way to do it. Tales from the road. This isn't one tale. It's kind of a bunch of tales, but they're the tales that can't be told. And for me, these are the moments that you are out there doing van life for. So I just drove to Texas and back to try to see the eclipse. We saw a little of it. You may have heard that Texas, the weather was terrible. We ended up not even driving to the site we had reserved. We ended up staying with friends in Houston, which was great. I mean, it was wonderful hanging out with the friends, and that was the main reason for me going. So I basically got everything I wanted. Did not see the eclipse in its full glory. And that's okay, because I have seen it before, and I may see it again. I'm working on some ideas about that. So, anyway, I had to get down to Texas, drove down there, and it's weird, because from Chicago to Houston, you get all the way to Texarkana on interstates, and then you're on these weird little back roads. And they're not really back roads, they're just what William Least Heat Moon would call blue highways. They're not interstates, they're state roads. Some of them are two-lane roads, but the speed limit is 75 miles an hour. And I want you right now to picture Texas in your mind. And what you're picturing is probably exactly the opposite of what I was driving through. I was driving through rolling hills and trees. It didn't look like Texas to me. And it was wildflower season, so there were wildflowers everywhere. It was absolutely beautiful. And I don't think I've ever said before that driving through Texas was absolutely beautiful. And there are nice parts here and there, don't get me wrong. This was gorgeous. This was the kind of drive that you would want to do. Also, there were great rest areas. Even on these little roads that weren't interstate, they had these great rest areas that allowed overnight parking. They explicitly allowed overnight parking. So I had all my parking taken care of. I basically camped in like this park-like atmosphere. They had separate spaces with picnic tables like at the rest areas, and you could just park in a designated spot right next to the picnic table. It was great. You know, hooray for Texas. I mean, that whole part of the trip was just wonderful. But there were a few moments coming back that reminded me of the movie Stand By Me, which we will remember was the novella The Body, written by Stephen King. And it's stated better in the book than it is in the movie, although it's very close. And there is a scene where the character played by Will Wheaton, the main character, I can't remember the character's name, but he gets up before the other kids, and I think he's going to pee, is what his goal was. You know, he wanders away from the camp, and he's in the woods. And he comes across a deer. And he's, you know, maybe 3 or 4 feet from the deer. And they just look at each other. And they just have this moment of boy meets deer. And then the deer scampers off and whatever. But the interesting thing about that encounter in the book is that Will Wheaton's character didn't tell anybody. He didn't run back and say, oh, look, I saw a deer. Because he knew that he had had a moment that could not be shared adequately. And I had several of those moments driving back from Texas. Now, my job here in this podcast is to tell tales. So these little bits that I'm going to tell you right now won't do anything justice because they can't. But hopefully they will remind you of moments like this that you've had yourself. So One of the moments I had was a very simple rainbow. I was driving along the highway and then to the right, and this was an open field part. I think I had actually left Texas at this point. This might have been in Arkansas. Open fields, dotted trees, a house here and there, and this massive rainbow. And I could see the entire thing from end to end. And as I was driving along at 70 miles an hour, I could actually see the end of the rainbow, you know, where the pot of gold is, moving. And I saw it light up a house. Now, I know how rainbows work, and I know the rainbow wasn't actually giving off light that was lighting up the house. But the effect for me was that this rainbow was kind of acting like a flashlight and shining on the ground, kind of like the aliens in Close Encounters of the Third Kind. And it went over this house and the house lit up. And I was like, that house just got its pot of gold. It sounds silly telling the story, but for me, living it, driving, it was just this wonderful, nice moment of, this is why I'm out here, to see this stuff. I'll just tell one more because I could go crazy with this stuff. Later on in the day, it's getting to be dusk, and I'm driving. And on the other side of the road, similar type of place, there's a lot of these places that are very flat like this where there's not much going on, massive storm clouds on the horizon. Those big, dark clouds that go all the way to the ground because it's pouring over there and have a shape. Nothing amorphous about these clouds. They look like a giant tree trunk that takes up half the horizon. No light is getting through these things. Just these gigantic things. So immediately I'm like, am I in any tornado danger here? And I checked everything and no tornado warnings in the area. And apparently the rain wasn't even going to reach me for some reason. I was driving northeast and the storm was heading southwest. For whatever reason, I was safe according to all the apps. So good. But it was calling my attention. I kept watching it. I could see lightning licking at the sides. And then, remember, this is sunset. And I'm driving northeast. The storm is to the west of me. The sun set behind the storm. And from time to time, like Sauron's eye from Lord of the Rings, this red circle would slowly open up in the middle of the storm, and then it would close again. And it looked all the world like a giant red eye blinking at me. Now, I know what it was. It was the sun at a very low angle coming through the storm, which varies in density, and some of the less dense areas let the light come through, but the only wavelength that could come through was red. I get the science behind it. I was not mystified by the science. I was mystified by the spectacle of being there at that moment in exactly the right place to see this phenomenon. And there were maybe only 5 people that could have seen it because you had to be exactly where I was, traveling at the speed I was, in the direction I was traveling in at that time. I took a picture of it. It's pathetic. It's a pathetic picture. It's one of these pictures you look at like, why'd you take that picture? But to live it, to live that moment, made that entire day's drive worth it. It was rejuvenating and exciting, and I really wish I could share it with some other folks. But I can't, and I've learned to accept that some of these moments are just for me, and there's a lot of van life that's just like that. A place to visit. This is not a place, it's every place. You have heard of geocaching. Geocaching and letterboxing, maybe you've heard of letterboxing. Geocaching is where you find these little caches in places and people put little knickknacks in there and usually a book. And you can sign your name and take a knickknack and leave a knickknack. It's a huge thing. In fact, I've done a bit of geocaching, but I don't do it so much now because there are so many geocaches that a lot of the challenge has been lost. Letterboxing is similar, except that there's a stamp, and you have your book, and you take your book, and you get a stamp. That's more of an English thing. Same idea, though. You're looking for these places. Well, there's another one that I haven't talked about in any depth before, and it's called Munzee. And it's kind of a 21st century version of this, but it also is a very good leave-no-trace principle for this type of thing. So Munzee is a service. You can go to munzee.com or download the Munzee app. That's M-U-N-Z-E-E. And instead of finding a box with a stamp or knickknacks in it, you find a barcode. And your goal is simply to scan that barcode with the Munzee app. And when you do that, you get points. Whoever put the sticker there gets points. And you can turn this into a game. It's like a very simple version of Pokemon Go, except you know where the Pokemon are and you always catch them. And Munzee, you know, they're trying to make money on this thing. So the Munzee app has all different ways to make money for them. You know, you can buy stickers and you can buy a premium thing. And there'll be contests, you know, your team versus another team, who can find the most Munzees and all that. But what I think is interesting is you can look at a map of where all the Munzees are. And you have to then ask yourself, why there? Now, there are Munzees in my neighborhood in Chicago, and I can see what the person did is they just put one on a pole every so many feet. And that's not that interesting. But what I think is interesting is if you put Munzees in places where stuff happened that maybe people don't know. So, for example, I live in an historic building. There was a famous murder here in 1897, I think. The Chicago Ghost Tours stop in front of my building to talk about it. But there's no way to know this if you're walking down the street. So I thought, what if I just put a little Munzee there and people can find it and read about it? Now, looking at the app, it doesn't look like they've taken that step. Like, you can get a lot of information about the place. It's just, hey, you found Munzee number 672. Congrats, here's your 10 points. What I would really like to see is this Munzee app say, congrats, you have found the sausage murder Munzee, and here's what happened. For more information, click here. I would really like to see something like that. There was a service in Chicago, I don't know if it's still going, where it's called Talking Statues, where somebody created these elaborate barcodes and put them on statues all across the city. And if you scanned them, the statue would speak to you, basically. They actually hired professional actresses and actors to have the statue come to life and explain who they are and why they're there and what they have seen over the years. And I thought that was pretty cool, too. But that's a separate thing. I'm talking about Munzee here. So if you ever thought that you would like to do the geocaching thing, but you weren't really interested in traipsing around in the woods, Munzee is a very low barrier entry type of way to do this kind of thing. Very easy to keep track of. And you can do it for free. You know, it's a freemium service, like World of Warships or World of Tanks or one of those, where you can play for free just fine. But the really cool stuff you have to pay for. Or even Discords like that. So, anyway. Enough! Check it out if you are so inclined. It is Munzee, the app. Link in the show notes. But, hey, you can just find M-U-N-Z-E-E, I'm pretty sure. Resource recommendation. Ha ha! This is a resource recommendation that you probably have never heard before. So I have never read Walden by Thoreau, despite growing up not far from Walden Pond. I had never read it. All I have seen are the quotes. You know, Henry David Thoreau quotes are everywhere, and people think of him as this guy who left civilization and went into the woods to live an authentic life. Blah, blah, blah. The real story isn't all that impressive, to be honest. And I listened to audiobooks. I decided I would read it. And the book is interesting, but not for the reasons I thought. I mean, yeah, it has all the quotes. You know, like, here's a quote. Rather than love, then money, then fame, give me truth. Or, the world is but a canvas to our imagination. Or, it's not what you look at that matters. It's what you see. I mean, ooh, it's really deep stuff. And yeah, that's in there, and you can get those tidbits. But most of the book is this pompous ass just criticizing everybody else and how they live their lives and pretending to be this pious man living in the woods while he's having his mother do his laundry in the town half a mile away. So, yeah. The resource that I'm recommending here isn't the book. It's this one very specific copy of the book that you can get on Audible. It is the one read by Robert Noel. It's actually credited to Robert Noel and The Glade. I'm not sure what The Glade is. I don't know, but that's who it's quoted to. Robert Noel and The Glade. And this recording is so over the top that it has become my go-to thing when I'm trying to fall asleep. So I don't listen to this while I'm driving. But literally, this entire trip I just took to Texas, at night, in the van. I want some little noise to help lull me to sleep. I'll fire up Audible, set the timer for 5 or 10 minutes, depending on how tired I feel. And I would listen to specifically chapter 9 of this book, where he talks about pawns. There's something about the cadence and over-pronunciation that this narrator does that makes this the most soporific work I have ever heard. And it's not like that sappy sleep story stuff that you can get from Alexa or whatever. It's not ASMR. No, it's just this guy speaking in this way that real, and I'm not making fun of him, actually. Sure, it makes me fall asleep, but it's nice. It's pleasant. And his way of speaking kind of mitigates some of the pomposity that was Henry David Thoreau. Now, according to the notes here, it's in the public domain. It says public domain 2023 by Icon Audio Arts, but I cannot find a copy of this except through a subscription service. So you might be able to get it for free. I don't know. But anyway, I have a link to the specific one. It's Walden by Henry David Thoreau, narrated by Robert Noel and The Glade. You can get it on Audible. You can get it on a bunch of other services. But man, I may never finish this book. I might just continue listening to Chapter 9 over and over and over again because it gets me right to sleep. Well, folks, thank you very much for listening to episode 207. Music, as always, is by Simon Wagg. If you would like to get a hold of me for any reason, you can find me at jeff@builttogo.com. That's 2 T's, not 3, not 1. And until next time, remember the words of course, Henry David Thoreau, who in his infinite wisdom said, "Do what you love. Know your own bone. Gnaw at it. Bury it. Unearth it. And gnaw it still." What?